Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking next about the ship that carried the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, and on her voyage back was torpedoed by a Japanese sub. What happened to the crew of the USS Indianapolis is what we'll be talking about next. And the authors of the new book, Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man. They're with us by phone today. Lynn Vincent, a U.S. Navy veteran and New York Times best-selling author. Lynn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Sarah Vladek, an acclaimed documentary filmmaker and one of the world's leading experts on the USS Indianapolis. Sarah Vladek, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This book has been extensively researched. I found it a fascinating book. It tells the story of many of the survivors, what happened afterwards. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. Love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. I was amazed at this book. I really enjoyed reading it. The depth of your work on this was absolutely fantastic. How did you get interested in the Indianapolis? Lynn, well, do you want to take that or Sarah?
Actually, I'll have Sarah take it because she started the project first.
All right.
So my initial interest started around when I was age 13, and I'd heard the story, but it was reduced to a single line, and it was the ship that carried the atomic bomb and was sunk, and that was all there was. And so going to the library and doing more research, it just continued to fuel that interest until later on when I was older and able to do something about it. And so at that point, you know, went on to find the survivors of the Indianapolis and came across Paul and Mary Lou Murphy out of Colorado, who were the chairman and secretary of the organization at the time, and they invited me to a reunion. And so from there, started meeting the survivors and learning their story, and really they kind of adopted me as a granddaughter and asked me to be their storyteller. And so, you know, that's where it all began and the interest began. But Lynn really came into it and joined the interview process and got to know the survivors as well. So they really kind of learned to trust us with their stories, and something that was invaluable to us and to the storytelling of this itself.
Yeah, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There have been other books written about the disaster. Why did you want to write another?
Larry, we wanted to take the story of Indianapolis and elevate it above a sinking story. A lot of people have heard of Indianapolis, especially through the film Jaws, where the Robert Shaw character, who plays the fishing boat Captain Quint, talks about surviving the sinking.
I've got a little video audio of that, too, by the way, which I want to play. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, perfect. But what a lot of people don't know is that Indianapolis was the flagship of the Pacific Fleet. And Admiral Raymond Spruance commanded the Pacific Theater from her decks. Indianapolis participated in 10 major battles, including Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And so you could argue that she was one of the decks from whose she was one of the ships from whose decks the war was won. And so we wanted to elevate the story above a sinking story and also really follow the story after the survival, the rescue, into the court-martial of Captain Charles B. McVey III and to his exoneration, which didn't happen until 50 years later.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you were able to do that. Certainly the parts about the in your book about the actual sinking and what went on those 4 days or so is really compelling. But I also found it very compelling just the introduction where you talk about the ship and sort of leading up to the whole disaster. And then what followed is just absolutely amazing story. You know what? Let's just set the scene right now. We've got the audio that you were just talking about from the from the movie Jaws, where Quint, I think it was played by Robert Shaw, launches, they're talking about experiences at sea, and he launches into, I think, probably one of the most famous monologues in film history about the fact that he was a part of the USS Indianapolis. And let's just listen. He's talking. They've all had a lot of drinks. Quint and Hooper are drinking, and the Sheriff Brody asks him, what the heck's the USS Indianapolis? And here's how he responded.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian Delady and just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo. And the idea was, shark comes the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eye. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you. And those black eyes roll over white, and then... oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces. Noon the fifth day, Mr. Hooper, Lockheed Ventura saw us. He swung in low and he saw us, Steve, a young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway. He saw us and he come in low, and 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. So 1,100 men went in the war. 360 men come out, and the sharks took the rest. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
You just get chills running up and down your spine, or at least I do when I hear that.
Still mesmerizing after all these years. That monologue is still mesmerizing.
And I have to tell you, it's the reading of your book, where you're in that part of the story that you told, is to me, it was equally mesmerizing. And I thank you so much for putting that all together, putting the book together. It must have. How many years did you spend on this, by the way?
Well, this is Sarah, and I began with it, like, as I mentioned, in about 2001, and interviews started in 2005. So there were many years of interviews and research done between Lynn and I, and by the time it was all said and done, it was 17 years.
Wow, 17 years. And as I listen back to Robert Shaw there talking, it reminded me that at least a couple of people who are play a kind of a central role in your book, William Toti and a young guy, Hunter Scott, were actually, I think, first interested because of that movie and Robert Shaw.
That's exactly right. One of the stories that we didn't really get a chance to tell in full detail in the book was how William Toti became interested. He was a plebe or a freshman at the U.S. Naval Academy, and in those days, they kind of hazed the plebes a little bit. So one of the things that they had to do was they had to go stand out under the clock at the big barracks there and call out the names of all the movies that were playing in town. And, of course, they weren't allowed to go off campus and see these movies. So after calling out that Jaws was playing down in downtown Annapolis for weeks and weeks and weeks during his plebe summer, that was the movie he wanted to go see. And he did go see it after plebe summer was over, and he was absolutely, like you and I mesmerized by the Quint speech. And so he went back to the academy and asked his professor, who's a very famous historian named E.B. Potter, hey, professor, is that a real story? And the professor said yes. And that was the first time that Bill Todi encountered the story of Indianapolis, and he had no idea that his life would, you know, become entwined with the ship and for decades. And he was one of the key people that helped exonerate the captain 50 years after the sinking of the ship.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing story. You know what? Vern and Stanley has a question. Let's just go there. Vern, thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I knew Mr. Carroll. Now, he was with the 592nd Bomber Squadron that put the atomic bomb on Norway on an island.
Yeah.
The Indianapolis took the parts for the atom bomb over there on its first trip. Had that ship been sunk, the atom bomb would never have been put together.
That's right. The ship was sunk only 4 days after dropping those components off at Tinian Island. But as we relate in the book, there was a moment of danger, well, two moments of danger while those components were aboard Indianapolis. And in one case, the ship, I wouldn't say almost capsized, but
Scared him pretty good.
And on the ship was a guy, Furman, was it? He had chased down the German bomb experts, and he actually delivered the bomb?
He did. He posed, he and another officer named James Nolan, posed as artillery officers, and they carried the components of the atomic bomb onto Indianapolis, and they kept those with them in their stateroom. Meanwhile, they used another large crate that contained unclassified materials, and they had that lashed to the hangar deck and put a Marine guard on it. And so the crew and the captain, well, not the captain so much, but the crew thought that whatever this hush-hush cargo was, it was in that box. And they actually placed bets and had bets going about what could possibly be in the box. And, of course, these are young sailors, 16, 17, 18 years old, so they guessed that the box contained everything from a car for General MacArthur to scented toilet paper to Rita Hayworth's lingerie. But the real components of the bomb were in the stateroom with Major Furman and Captain Nolan, and they posed as artillery officers, even though Furman was, in fact, the chief of intelligence under Leslie Groves for the entire Manhattan Project.
Yeah, I mean, weren't some of the parts in, like, suitcases or in briefcases or something like that?
They were actually in canisters. There were two canisters that they were in, and they were in the stateroom where they kept them for the duration of the journey.
Oh. Vernon, Stanley, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We are talking today with Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. They are the authors of the book Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. It's a fascinating book, and I'm really glad to have them with us today. And you know what? They're going to be with us right up till about 12:30 today as we visit with them. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. The number's 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Back with our guests right after this quick look at the news and weather. Well, it sounds like it may have been written in Hollywood, but the story of the USS Indianapolis and its crew is very true. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network, talking with the authors of a new book about the ship and the events surrounding its sinking in 1945, just days before the end of World War II. With me, Lynn Vincent. She is the U.S. Navy veteran and a New York Times best-selling author. She's co-author of 11 nonfiction books. She's written more than 1,000 articles, and her investigative pieces have been cited before Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court. Her co-author, Sarah Vladek, is an acclaimed documentary filmmaker, one of the world's leading experts on the USS Indianapolis. And in 2016, she released an award-winning documentary film on the disaster called USS Indianapolis, the legacy. As you listen in, you may be familiar with the story of the ship and its crew, may have some questions about the rescue, or maybe about the court-martial of its captain. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And before we go back to the phones, you do include a lot of information about the events around the dropping of the bomb itself, and the battle for Okinawa really affected that decision, did it not? Lynn, maybe you, or do you want to go to Sarah?
Well, this is Lynn. It did. The battle for Okinawa was really pivotal for Truman's decision as to whether to drop the atomic bomb or not. Now, this is, 73 years after the fact, and of course the decision to drop the bomb is extraordinarily controversial. In those days, it was really a game of numbers, meaning that Truman, having observed the carnage at Okinawa, was trying to avoid a similar disaster, and I believe I tallied it up, and it was about 250,000 people lost on Okinawa between the Japanese and American militaries and the civilians who lived there. And so the estimates of the number of fatalities from dropping the bomb was far, far less than that, maybe by two-thirds. And so that was one of the pivotal pieces of information that Truman had when he made the decision to drop that bomb.
Yeah. Oh, let's take a call. Ron in La Crosse, it's your turn. Ron, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I saw a docudrama on TV titled about the Indianapolis, titled The Mission of the Shark, and Stacy Keach played the Captain McVeigh, Richard Thomas played the ship's doctor, and they went extensively about into the court-martial, the way that was reenacted. Also, I don't know if your guest mentioned it in the book, but the radio man aboard the Indianapolis did manage to send out an SOS for the ship sank, and they did receive that SOS on Tinian Island, but I heard the communications officer dismissed it as a Japanese trick to lure American vessels towards the Jap subs.
They certainly do write about that. And Sarah, comment?
Yes, there has been a lot of discussions about the SOS that was sent off, and the crew members in the radio division did talk about it in that they believe that it did go out. What there is not confirmation on is whether it was received. And in every ship log and every report and all the various commands, there is no paperwork, there's no documentation whatsoever that an SOS was ever received. It wasn't a matter of something covered up, it wasn't there. And so, later there had been reports coming in from young sailors who said that they had heard about it or that they received something, but there's absolutely nothing to back that up.
Nothing. And when the ship, this whole sinking was horrendous, of course. But when the ship was sunk, there was oil and gas that went into the water, and then the sailors who were able to jump into the water had to jump right into it, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. That was actually released on purpose. It was actually fuel oil, and it's really a substance that I don't think any of us have much familiarity with, but it was so thick that it had to be heated in order to be transferred. So there was about, a mile or so of this thick winding mat of this fuel oil that actually sat on top of the water in a layer that was about an inch or two thick. And so when the men jumped into the water, many, many of them jumped right through this fuel oil, and for their entire 5 nights and 4 days in the water, they were absolutely covered in it. And so it was a great source of misery. It burned their eyes incredibly badly. But in a strange way, it was also a blessing because the fuel oil in some ways protected them from the sun. And also when Chuck Gwynn, the Ventura pilot that spotted the survivors, spotted anything down there, it was the oil that he spotted, because you could not have seen a human head or even 300 human heads from the altitude that the plane was flying at. what he saw was a reflection off the oil, and that's what caused him to dive down.
It's just an absolutely amazing luck, frankly, that he saw it.
Absolutely, because a pilot flying at the altitude that he was flying at can see 400 square miles at a glance, and the ocean that day was just like glass, so it would have taken someone looking at that exact spot at the exact moment that the sun hit it right for them to see it amid that 400-mile grid.
And he was actually looking, wasn't he looking down because he was trying to fix an antenna or something like that, and that is what caused him to actually see it?
That is correct. He had been installing a new antenna, and they were having a lot of trouble with it, and they continuously broke. And so he, you know, once again, this antenna broke, and he went to the back and was fiddling with it and looked down, and that's when he saw this oil slick. And he was actually, you know, ordering the men aboard his plane to open the bomb bays they were going to attack, thinking it was an enemy submarine. And when that's when he spotted heads in the water.
Yeah, just absolutely amazing. Well, prior to that, those 4 days and five nights, as we heard the, as we heard Robert Shaw talking as Quint, the horror in that monologue played out pretty much in many ways the way he described it, did it not?
It did, and probably it was even worse. At that time in the Philippine Sea, there were many, many more sharks than there are today, just because so many of them have died, you know, just over time and through overfishing. Also, the water was much more clear, and so the men floating out there 280 miles from the nearest land could see 50 feet straight down before the water turned blue and they couldn't see any farther. And so if you can imagine floating out there in just a life jacket, or maybe just clinging to your buddy who had only a life jacket because you didn't have one, they would look down and see literally hundreds and hundreds of sharks swirling like tornadoes below them.
And sometimes they would attack?
Yep. Tell about Eugene Morgan, the attack that he saw.
Yes, Eugene Morgan, who is one of the sailors, throughout the story, you know, or throughout the time in the water, he had talked about the things that the men faced. And one of the stories he shared was that there were about 15 men on a floater net, which was the, you know, these nets that had cork pieces on it to keep it afloat. And there were 15 men on this, and about 10 sharks attacked all at once. And by the time everyone opened their eyes, because to block everything out from the screaming and visually what was happening, all the men were gone. And this happened repeatedly.
It was just absolutely, and people were driven mad, essentially.
Yes, the men were driven over the edge, really. It was a combination of exposure to the sun, dehydration, which would cause their brain cells to tear loose and blood vessels to pop. And just the exposure in general drove them mad, and sometimes they would begin to attack each other even. And covered with the fuel oil as they were, sometimes they mistook each other for enemy sailors, and they would say, oh, there's a Japanese sailor, and they would attack. And some of the men had knives, and so battles broke out all throughout the survivor groups, and that's the way a lot of the men died.
It's just terrible. Well, so many people want to visit with you. I just want to go to, and we'll get to Jim and Rice Lake here in just a minute. We got Trevor and Ralph as well waiting online. But after they were discovered, the information radioed in, and a ship immediately stormed as fast as they could to the site, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, so it was the afternoon of the fourth day when they were spotted. And at that point, when Chuck Gwynn called in the distress saying, ducks on the pond, seeing men are in the water, it took 12 hours for the ships to arrive. And that was, you know, the land was 280 miles away. So by the time the ships arrived, it was just after midnight on Friday morning. They had sunk just after midnight on Monday. And so they arrived, you know, then and started picking the men up in the water. And that was the first time any of these men were identified as crew of the Indianapolis. Nobody knew up until that point who they were.
And one of the pilots of one of the, I forget the name of the airplane now off the top of my head, but actually landed in the water to pick up survivors against orders.
Yes, that is absolutely one of my favorite parts of the story. This pilot, who was actually an attorney by trade and had joined to fight the enemy, as many civilians did in World War II, he was a pilot of a PBY, or a Catalina, which is also called a Dumbo. And he got out there to the scene and couldn't believe what he was seeing. And as it was against regulations for him to land that plane in the water, but he could look down and see men, even as he flew over them, still being taken by sharks. And he, like as Sarah said, he knew that no ships would arrive in the area until midnight. So against regulations, he decided to land his plane in the water. And it was just absolutely one of the most courageous things I've ever heard of, because nobody in the Dumbo squadrons wanted to land their plane in the water because it was a very dangerous operation.
And he managed to get, what, 50-some people up onto the plane, even tying some of them to the wings.
Yes, they ran out of space in the hull of the plane, and they asked the men if they were able to crawl up and go on the wings. And so there were quite a few. I think there was as many as 20 men up on the wings, and then they covered them with parachutes and kind of tied them down and secured them until the ships could arrive.
And when the ships did arrive, there was one guy who I was just absolutely amazed at his heroism, Van Wilp, jumped in and saved many men because people were dying as they were picking them up and getting eaten as they were picking them up.
Yes, it was incredibly courageous what he did. I mean, sharks are attacking and these men are delirious. And, you know, they don't really know who these rescuers are because they're not in their right mind at this point. And so he jumped in, and he actually talked them into doing a conga line so that they would follow him to the LSTs because they weren't buying it. They didn't know who they were. So they're like, well, why would we come with you? And so he tricked them into doing a conga line, and they actually followed him and got onto the LSTs and were brought back to the ship. So he did this. He dislocated both shoulders, pulling men into these boats, and so, you know, and continued to work through that for hours, and he is just incredible.
And he actually went back to his home state of New Jersey and took a very humble job as a school custodian, and it wasn't until 50 years or so later that the people in the town realized that they had this hero among them, and he received a meritorious service medal 50 years after the fact for his heroism.
Yeah, it was just an amazing story. Well, Jim and Rice Lake, thank you so much for waiting. What's on your mind?
I have a question. Wasn't the part of the motivation for the court-martial of the captain was a whitewash or an attempt to cover up the failure of Naval Command to notice the overdue status of the Indianapolis? And secondly, wasn't there the supposed legal basis for the court-martial, the failure of the Indianapolis to zigzag from submarine conduct, wasn't that in fact contradicted by congressional testimony of the Japanese commander who said it didn't matter if he zigzagged, he was going to get the boat anyway?
Yeah.
Thanks for that question. One of the things we tried to do in this book was to kind of take a step back, and rather than treating the court-martial of Captain McVeigh as kind of an expose, we really, really researched it and just tried to observe what we thought was happening. One of the new pieces of information that we came across was a letter dated November 10th from Admiral Charles Snyder, who was the Inspector General of the Navy, to Fleet Admiral Ernest King, who was both in charge of the Navy and also the convener of the court-martial. And in that letter, which he received 3 weeks before the court-martial was to begin, the Navy listed all of the admirals that should have been held accountable for the sinking of Indianapolis, not for the sinking itself, but for the delay in rescue. and for the fact that McVeigh wasn't zigzagging at all because they hadn't given him the proper intelligence to say that the Philippine Sea was dangerous. So to your question about the motivation, we feel that it's something that we see in the military a lot, which is trying to place blame at the lowest level so that people who are of higher ranks don't have to endure that harsh glare of punishment in the public spotlight. And you have to remember that we had just won the most costly and deadliest war in human history, and some of the people that were on Admiral Snyder's list were some of the leading lights of the war. And so our analysis is that Admiral King didn't want to drag those admirals out into open court. As to the zigzagging, Commander Hashimoto did testify at the court-martial, which was just scandalous. No one had ever seen a defeated enemy called over to testify in the trial of a decorated American officer. And he was only speaking Japanese, and there was a translator there, Captain Bromley, who was translating his words into English. And so Commander Hashimoto basically, in a paraphrase fashion, I'm paraphrasing, he said in Japanese, it didn't matter if he had been zigzagging, I would have hit him no matter what. But that's not quite what Captain Bromley said. And later, when he went home and he was talking to his family, Hashimoto told them that Captain Bromley did not translate what he had said properly.
And he actually later on was involved in this effort, which took over 50 years to have McVeigh exonerated.
Yes, shortly, actually, before he had passed away, Commander Hashimoto had written a letter to Senator Warner saying, you should not continue to punish this man. You should not tarnish his name. He was not responsible for this. I would have sunk it anyway. And that really helped in Warner's decision to continue to let this go to the Senate floor.
Yeah, absolutely amazing that he would do that in some ways, but the rest of his family got involved. I know, right, kind of right at near the very end of your book, you talk about, I think it was his daughter and granddaughter.
Yes, Atsuko Ida and her family came, and that's the granddaughter of Hashimoto, came to the reunion. She had come earlier, and this was the first time she brought her whole family and her children to the 2005 reunion. And that was really a great moment because with that, the children of the survivors and the grandchildren of the survivors were able to meet with the family of Hashimoto, and it really healed both of them.
Absolutely amazing. And the other young guy that I did want to mention was Hunter Scott, who is, 11 years old, and he sees Jaws, and that gets him interested in the Indianapolis, and his eloquence as time went on was amazing.
Hunter was really a game changer in the fight to exonerate Captain McVeigh. The survivors had fought for that beginning really after their first reunion in 1960, and efforts continued and built, and as they met more and more and they got older and older, they could see that the Navy was being very intransigent. The Navy was not going to exonerate Captain McVeigh, no matter how many times the survivors went to Washington, D.C. and lobbied their congressmen. So after Hunter Scott saw Jaws, it was his dad's favorite movie, he said, hey, Dad, I need a project for the school history fair. And that's how it began. Hunter did a blue ribbon winning project for his school history fair. And then his congressman got wind of this, and his congressman was a man named
Joe Scarborough
of Florida's 1st District. Of course, Joe is now on MSNBC, but at the time he was a congressman. And so Congressman Scarborough took up the cause, and aided by Hunter Scott and all the research that Hunter had done, they wrote a resolution for Congress, which they presented in 1998, I believe, and that resolution failed, but they didn't give up. And Hunter continued to fight that fight and went to Senator Bob Smith And Senator Smith is the one that got the Senate Armed Service Committee hearing that led to the exoneration of Captain McVeigh.
And absolutely amazing. I just want to mention that by chance, Trevor and Madison called to say that today at Madison's Dane County Airport, we have one of the two aircraft that dropped the bomb coming in today at 2 o'clock with a public viewing tomorrow. So kind of... I'm so sorry that we are out of time. You have written just an absolutely wonderful book, and I want to thank you both so much for all of the work you did with it. How many survivors are left?
There are currently 14 survivors.
14 left. Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek, again, thank you both so much for being with us today, authors of the book Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Seas Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man. I hope you have a chance to read the book and to look at it. It's an absolutely amazing story and very, very well written. And I want to thank you so much for listening, and please do stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.